history is, they tell us, they don't tell us we're not supposed to be interested in history. We are supposed to be interested in it as they present to us, which turns out to be these really deadly dull stories of men and white people and rulers and great men and big men and all the exploits of men. And the women are pretty much out of the picture. You have some queens, some concubines, a couple famous women sort of detached from the whole fabric of society, just standing out there, unusual little outliers. And so what I want to do in these podcasts is to really scan the cultural record for the juicy stuff. There is so much out there that is not boring at all. It's like when you're dealing with people, there are interesting things to be found. And I'm going to be ranging really widely over the whole planet, all time periods, but the glue for all of this is the female angle. And where are the women in the mix? And so for those who aren't familiar with it, I wanted to say something about the Suppressed Histories Archives, which is really the foundation, the research on which this podcast is based. And the aim of the archives is to scan the cultural record for knowledge about women, how women lived, what they did, what they achieved, their cultural production, their creativity, their inventions, and the documentation of them in the cultural record. This is the hard part, is tracking that down. In 1970, when I began, it seemed like, well, no, there isn't anything. It's all destroyed. That was how it seemed at that point in time, as I was looking in the card catalogs at major universities and women, housewife, dating, makeup, fashion, cooking, motherhood, all of those types of things, models, you know. And so missing from that particular slice of the cultural record in that period of time, North America, 1969, there was no ken, no hint even of priestesses or medicine women or women warriors who led insurrections against empire. It was just not on the radar at all, much less social systems in which women had formal authority of any kind, economic power, technological know-how, women who were providers, women who created the bulk of the food supply, who did technological innovations. All of that was completely off the radar at that time. I mean, there were women in 1969 who were, Evelyn Leacock was writing her book, Woman the Gatherer, because the whole emphasis of sort of a sociobiology interpretation of history would have it that, you know, man the hunter. It was all man the hunter. And, you know, the bargains that women had to make to get meat from man the hunter, and the power that he had over women, and you know, these sort of projections of 1950s housewives back through the evolutionary scale into, you know, the distant past, and you know, really just that nothing had changed, or if it had changed, we have a much better situation now. This was the basic line: women, you're better off now, because before it was really bad. So just be quiet. You know, deal with it, because it was worse before. So, you know, those are my reasons for gathering, trying to document women's history. And my approach has come about very quickly to work through image, to teach through images. And so the archives, the Suppressed Histories Archives, contains thousands of images, digital slides, hard copies, every form you could think of, newspaper clippings. And, you know, from all fields, it really is necessary to have an interdisciplinary view in researching women's history. And what I mean by that is you have to look at archaeology, history, art history, comparative religion, or in indigenous orature. There's just a whole range of source material. And sometimes some of the juiciest things are found in books on weaving or obscure types of sources that most people would not really think about unless they were weavers, unless they were midwives. And so those corners, there's like these little pockets, these gaps where information is sequestrated in the cultural record. And so that's what I've made my job, my business, to excavate and try to find out, where is it? Where are the women? What can we know about them? You know, how can we interpret the archaeological record, for example? And so all of this is the hidden part of the iceberg, the biggest part that's under the waterline, under the historical waterline. And this is a feminist undertaking, which, in my view, to be truly feminist, our lens has to be aware of all forms of domination. And so we look at class systems and colonial and imperial systems of domination, racialized caste, settler societies vis-a-vis indigenous cultures. And looking at the polities of those indigenous cultures in ways that have not been very common up till very recently, which is to see them as in their own terms, for one thing, using the source material really comes from indigenous sources. That's the authentic, that's the authoritative information, you know. And so our job is to gather that, to be informed by it, to reconstruct it as best we can, and, you know, to bear witness to it, to signal boost it. And that's a lot of this process of reconstructing history with new eyes and with old eyes, you know, with an ancient gaze. And so, you know, we look at those forms of domination, and we also look at how they shape interpretation of the cultural record. In fact, how they actually shape that record themselves. You know, all of the ways that rulers are our sources, and official government documents are records, and we have to kind of learn to read through them in order to see what was really going on, to get a glimpse of the lives of common women. That's often the very hardest piece to find. You know, you've got the doings of the elite, and the elite men especially. And so the common woman is very, very hard to find under all those layers. And sometimes there are aspects of the cultural record that have been destroyed. You know, we can see visual evidence of that in the smashed statues in ancient Egypt and various other parts of the world, you know, as part of the process of conquest, or the institution of a new degree of patriarchal domination. That's part of it. But some of the subjects that I want to look at in the course of these podcasts, I mean, this for me is very freeing, because normally I'm either writing articles, I'm writing books. I do post little stub blog posts on the Suppressed Histories Archives page on Facebook. But, you know, it's written, and it has the strength of being able to use, to go off of those visual, you know, picture worth a thousand words resources. But there's something about being able to talk about the information. It's a different medium. Audio is a different medium. So I want to just kind of scan over some of the types of subjects that we're going to be discussing on these podcasts on History Sybil. And that includes everything from women in ancient Nubia, medieval Nubia, the persistent mother right cultures there, the midwife healer ceremonialists in Nubia, the conquests of Nubia, and that whole imperial history and how it impacted that very important ancient culture, very pivotal culture in the history of the world. I want to look also at the ancient Sahara. I'm going to be making some maps around that as I come forward with the visual webcast on the ancient Sahara in future time, maybe not this year, later this year, maybe 2018. Neolithic Egypt. And in this current podcast, I have an illustration posted, which is something I just ran across. And this is really testimony to the unfolding of history that happens as sources that were not visible before suddenly heave into view, suddenly get past gatekeepers who were sitting on top of them, and photographs become available of petroglyphs, and in this particular case from the region of Kom Ombo, which is in Nubia, southern Egypt, north of the Aswan Dam. And so the petroglyphs I'm talking about are ceremonial scenes showing river boats and invoking women. And this is a theme well known in pre-dynastic Nubian, ancient Egyptian civilization. There are these petroglyphs of invoking women. There are the river boats, ceremonial boats that we hear about later on in Egyptian history. But there are also several different media that show invoking women in the Nile Valley, you know, what we'll say centered on Nubia. And so we have the petroglyphs, and then we have painted ceramics, and they're quite numerous, showing women, goddesses, priestesses, however you want to see these women with their arms raised in invocation, sometimes riding in river boats, or sometimes standing on the land, sometimes towing the boat up the Nile. And then there are others still that are ceramic sculptures of vulture-headed goddesses or other female figures, many times with the arms, again, raised in the gesture of invocation or benediction if they happen to be goddesses. And then there are also linen paintings, and there is one example of a mural from the early dynastic period, also in Nubia, I think near Abydos. And so that right there is five different media that are showing this theme, and it's showing us how pivotal female invocation was to Egyptian ceremonial culture, religion, society before the pharaohs. So that's an example. And the finding of this photograph for me is interesting, because a lot of times what happens in my research is that years or even decades will go by before I'll catch another piece. So this particular petroglyph from Kom Ombo is, I had a picture of part of it. And that was a picture of a figure in the boat, kind of an ungendered figure, can't tell for sure, arms raised and standing in the boat, and the oars, the rowers aren't really shown, but many, many oars. And so this colossal figure inside the boat. Turns out this is the right part of the petroglyphic ceremonial scene that I'm telling you about here. And so, you know, it's just like the whole thing. I could never get a picture of the whole thing. I didn't know there was more. I thought, okay, there's just this one thing. But, you know, by now I've learned, no, there always could be more. And there usually is. But it's just waiting for that other shoe to drop, and for that piece of information to appear, for the veil to be ripped off of it so that it can be known. So that's ancient Egypt has been a long fascination of mine, and we're going to be talking about that on and off. We're going to be looking at seers and shamans and medicine women, wise women, priestesses. This is a book that I'm going to be doing a series of essays, hopefully published next year, about that. And I have already published a 3-hour DVD video called A Woman Shaman, the Ancients, that really looks at the visual documentation from the cultural record with that theme in mind. You know, just looking for the women, because so often in the standard literature not starting with Mircea Eliade, but certainly his book really did focus on the males and even posited males as the primordial shamans, that women weren't really allowed to be, according to him. But there is, in fact, massive documentation in the archaeological record, including rock art, bronzes, all kinds of different artistic documentation of female spiritual leadership, ecstatic dancers, you name it, medicine women. So that's a topic. And related to that, in a women's ceremony, things like ceremonial paint-up and tattooing, this is one area where we're going to come back to Egypt, is ancient Egyptian women's tattoos, which is something that shows up a lot, particularly in the burials of priestesses of Hathor. That's a definite theme that shows up. But also really trying to map out North American countries. What did Turtle Island look like before the European invasions and conquests, the colonization, which continues to this date, pipelines and all? And, you know, both large range mapping of language groups and archaeological sites and things like that, but also trying to update the concept of Native peoples, of First Nations peoples, you know, in the present, because so often people have this fixation that is something that exists in the past, instead of living traditions that are fighting to survive, that are attempting to recover cultural heritage, language, and land base. You know, land base that was seized, theft and conquest. So that'll be a theme that we're looking at. And there's just a whole lot of different subject areas, you know, whether it's Roman coins showing Moroccan women as Amazons, or female bagpipers in Western Europe in the Middle Ages, or spiral painted ceramic masterpieces from Alabama or China, Costa Rica, Romania, lots of examples in the ancient Neolithic. Healers among the Black Caribs, some of the healing ceremonies around the Caribbean, both on the mainland of South America and also in Central America and the Caribbean. And icons of matrilineal societies in the Congo, the Kishi figures of the maternal ancestors, and the patterns that are associated with them. Women's councils among the Wayuu in Colombia, and many other societies. I mean, this is an aspect of matricultures, whether we're talking about the Six Nations of the Iroquois or any other matrilineal society. This is a recurring theme. The Cherokee had women's councils. Many peoples have had that, or have even had women who are clan heads, as we find with the Moswa society in southwestern China, in Yunnan region. And that's an area that I'd like to talk about more, if I can dig through my notes, and maybe I'll just do a podcast about Yunnan and all of the matricultural patterns that exist there. There are, of course, the Moswa, who I consider one of the more egalitarian cultures on the planet, but also the Lahu and other peoples. There are a lot of matrilineal societies, or sometimes bilateral, but the social system is organized in such a way that you have female clan heads or you have female courtship. Sometimes in southern Cambodia, I've read about longhouse peoples who are matrilineal, who have courtship lodges for young people to hang out and kick it together, and for lovemaking, you know, not as a stigmatized thing, not as something subject to patriarchal controls, but just a normal part of life, unstigmatized, and, you know, the joy of life. So that's, you know, that whole region of Southeastern Asia is really interesting. The Austronesian peoples and the Austroasiatic speakers, you have matricultural patterns very strong among both of those linguistic groups. And so we're going to look at Yunnan at some point in these webcasts. But we can also look at Lesbiana, Greta Garbo's lovers and Frida Kahlo's lovers and women-loving women around the world and what they called them. You know, Audre Lorde said Zami, a new spelling of my name from her maternal island of Carioku in the Grenadine Islands, Lesser Antilles, in the far reaches of the Caribbean. And we can talk also about, well, there's some amazing Brazilian women, both the warrior women like Dandara dos Palmares, who was a female leader in one of the most important of the Maroon settlements. These were Africans who escaped from slavery and established independent states in the forests of Brazil. And dos Palmares was one of the best known and the longest lived of them, maybe the largest as well. And so there are a lot of important female figures associated with that one or with others. And so those are amazing stories, but it's not only just on that level of social leadership or military leadership of the women warriors, but also very strong spiritual leadership by Afro-Brazilian women. And this is through Candomblé and various nations, the Cabildos, that were established by people of African descent in the diaspora under conditions of slavery. And you know, you have the traditions of Angola and Congo and the Yoruba traditions. There's many nationalities who came over and were able to sustain their language, their dances, their deities, the drum patterns in pretty intact form, in spite of slavery. This was really a basis for resistance for them, and as well as identity. So Brazil's got lots of interesting things to talk about in the native traditions as well, and the stories about Amazons, not just from the Spanish and the Portuguese who came in and said, oh yeah, look, there's women warriors and, you know, telling tales about what they saw on their travels, but really actually indigenous stories about women who lived without men. And so lots of interesting sidebars to those stories, like the sacred pools of the Jamunda women who dived into the waters and would pull out frogs who would turn to stone. They would turn to green stone jade when they hit the air. The Muirakitan is the name for these little icons, and they are found a lot in eastern Brazil, the Tapajós region also. And so there's a lot of interesting connection of these Muirakitan to chiefly women. And so you will see the Europeans describing how the wives of chieftains wore these Muirakitan. And we can look through the bias of those reports and see that actually these women had standing in their own right. They're not just the wives, you know, in the European method of Mrs. John Smith. You know, they have actual authority. They have culture-making power of their own, and they may have had, it's very likely that the wearers of Muirakitan had spiritual authority, leadership, culture-making power. So lots more to say about indigenous Brazil. I've become interested in the Botocudos people, who are a very ancient group in Brazil who have a unique genomic pattern, but also very strong matrilineal culture. So we're going to go into those at some point. And then there's all kinds of other things from the written record. I mean, a lot of what I'm referring to here is in societies that had orature, which is, you know, if you think about it, a counterpart to literature. Orature means knowledge that's preserved in memory through the oral tradition. So orature is a really important source of testimony about women, female lives, female women who are remembered by culture, in culture, you know, in the genealogies and the histories of Native peoples. And this is one of the richest sources when I began first doing this research, is to find where are they, you know, where are the women? And so I began to notice that The history books were pretty thin on this. You know, sometimes nothing at all. You could go through many volumes and not see a whiff of a female anywhere, unless she was a wife. But over time, I saw that it was indigenous oral history where women really stood out as leading figures, even founding figures. And so sticking with South America for a minute, in Peru, you have Mama Huaco as a foundational figure for the Quechua people, and she performs certain ritual acts that lead to the foundation of Cusco. The actual divination of where to settle is led by her, by Mama Huaco, which you could translate as the sacred mother. This word Huaco also is used in Peru to refer to holy places. And so the pyramids of northern Peru in the Moche country are known as Huacos. And so lots of connections there to be pursued. But in the actual historical record itself, places where we do have a written testimony, there are some interesting things to be dug out. And some of this is hidden by multiple means. First, because it's female. Second, because it's in languages and cultures that are not easily accessible to people who are reading in English or any of the European languages. So one of these figures is Masati Ganjavi. And she was a Sufi poet from Ganje in Azerbaijan in the 1100s. And her name is interesting. Masati means moon lady in Persian. And so really the name isn't an actual birth name as we would know it. She's the moon lady of Ganje. That's the meaning of her name, Masati Ganjavi. But what we do know about her is that she was very respected in Iran for her courageous poetry, because she condemned religious fanaticism or doctrine, dogma, the hypocrisy of observing religious rules without any humanity, without any compassion or sense of real justice. And so there are monuments to Masati. But she was a poet. And so this is what we know mostly about her, is the surviving Rubaiyat, right? Same as Omar Khayyam, same quatrains that were the basis of medieval Persian poetry at the time. So here's a little piece from her that I found. No force can bind us. Pull of moment, arrows flying home. Nor any wild nostalgia that seized our hearts whilom. Though my soft braids turned chains of steel and anchored in your heart, could any chain keep me at home if I should wish to roam? And so there's that spirit of freedom that comes through very strongly, independence and self-determination in the poems of Masati Ganjavi. And there are stories about her being an associate or a companion of Omar Khayyam, of the Sultan Sanjar. And there are rumors that you will read that she was a female libertine, which may or may not be the case, but it's hard to tell, because any woman who defies patriarchal constraints gets branded as, you know, being a free lover. And so, you know, we get a lot of hearsay and not very much fact. You know, so for example, Jauhari of Bukhara recounts her quote unquote purported love affairs. And we don't really know if this is true or not. It could have been true. She did do erotic poetry. And she was an influential poet. Another great female poet of Iran, Jahan Khatun of Shiraz, was influenced by her. And so were also male poets and satirists. And so, but she did become notorious for her liberated behavior. She was acting as a free woman, and a lot of men and some women disapproved of this. So that's an example of a nugget. I found a picture of her that I posted on the Suppressed Histories page on Facebook. You can find if you scroll through the photo section there. Modern painting, it's not contemporary, but, you know, an imagination of what this bold female spirit from the 12th century would have looked like, perhaps. So that's my intro. There's going to be more. I want to talk about persecutory culture, because this is something that's really up right now. It's a current and present danger. The use of epithets and blood libels, accusations, expulsion, mob violence, or incitements to mob violence, shunning, all these different kinds of behavior. And, you know, we have the spectacle, as I'm recording this, of children being shipped in freight trains to, once upon a time, Walmart's now detention centers for children who have been torn apart from their parents and the process of deportation under the current regimes. Dangerous times, scary times, children with numbers attached to them as they're sent off to these holding tanks, concentration camps, call them what you will. And I want to also talk about dangerous women. I'm going to be doing a visual webcast on this coming up later this year, and looking at women who fight against injustice, you know, and so dangerous women, they fight back. That's the subtitle. Because I think we need models. We need to understand what it takes to defy the imperatives of power over, of systemic social domination and injustice. And we need to know also, in addition to resistance, we need to know what it is to build coalitions. How, again, to return to a culture of holding counsel, a culture of respectful speech and discourse. None of this bullying and silencing that's been so pervasive and current on social media and in some movements as well. So there'll be more topics. I'm probably going to have announced topics, or at least as the webcasts come about, they won't be as wide-ranging as this one. I'm trying to give you just basically some of the scope that will be discussed here. Some of the webcasts, I'm going to be giving you advanced views from my books in the series Secret History of the Witches, which is a women's view of European history and how the intensification of patriarchy came about, how women got banned from the priesthood and economically subordinated. And part of that story will include excerpts from Volume 6, which isn't in print yet. But I want to talk about the coloni. Well, this is our word from which colonies and colonization come, and it refers to a class of serfs who were maybe originally slaves in the late days of the Roman Empire and the years that followed it. But coloni, or and especially the colona, the female serf, you know, and again, this is a very hard reality to track, but it's important to look at. And so one of the webcasts I'm going to be doing coming up fairly soon is looking at these old names for serfs in Europe after the fall of Rome. And one of the names, besides coloni, that's the plural, is nativi, natives, the word natives, people who are born in the place, nativi. And so, you know, this becomes a synonym for someone who has fallen into bondage, who has been forced into bondage. And so it underlines a pattern of subjugating indigenous people or the native people, let's put it that way, of you know, the countries in Europe in this case. So that's going to be a webcast that I'd like to do, because I realized that I have 16 books in this series, and I've only published one so far, and that was 2 years ago. I'm working on getting volume 2 out, and that will be about women in Hellenic culture, both the positive heritages, the very deep matricultural patterns, and also what we have to really look at in the foundations of Western Civ. We have to see the enforcement of patriarchy, of class domination, especially of slavery, the colonizations that begin in that era. And, you know, these are models for later forms of Western Civ in the Roman Empire and all of its successor states. And so decolonization means we have to understand the roots. We need to be able to see what happened, how it happened, and describe those injustices and describe how they were accomplished in order to understand somehow how to get out, how to break out of these constantly repeated patterns. You know, the famous quote about those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. It's being repeated, and you know, not in a good way. This is all very maladaptive. So I want to turn a lens on a lot of these dynamics, both the positive heritages and also the systemic domination, and seeing how that comes about and looking at it, you know, with a new eye. So that is the task of a history sibyl, is to tell the truth, the hidden truth, the forbidden truth. And so that is what we're going to be doing here. I hope you'll join us for future webcasts. I am going to be posting these links on Patreon. And if you would like to support this work, if you like what I'm doing, then you're invited to become a sponsor over there on Patreon/Max-Shu. And I'll have more links about that as we go along. So looking forward to sharing all of this with you.